Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this March 2nd, 2021. Our first item of business will be for Mr. Dodge to take the role to establish a quorum. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Hornstein, present. Vice Chair Cagle.
Present.
Cagle, present. Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Barr.
Present.
Barr, present. Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Elkins.
Present.
Elkins, present. Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick. Representative Houseman.
Present.
Houseman, present. Representative Heinrich.
Present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Nelson, present. Representative Olson.
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Richardson.
Present.
Richardson, present. Representative Torkelson.
Present.
Torkelson, present. Representative West.
Present.
West, present. It is a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge. Our next item of business is approval of the minutes. And so we have two sets of minutes, members, for approval today, February 25th, Thursday, February 25th, and Friday, February 26th. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like a motion for both at once or separately?
I think you can combine, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, I move the approval of the minutes of February 25th and 26th.
There's a motion and discussion. Seeing none, we can do this, members, as a voice vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, and the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. So we have several bills on the agenda today. The first one will be House File 9 from Representative Greenman, and I will move that House File 9 be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education. And I know Representative Greenman, first of all, welcome to the Transportation Committee. And I know you have a couple of author's amendments, so if you want to incorporate those now, we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I believe it's A13 and A14, and I would like to put them on before we hear the bill.
Okay, and Representative Greenman, why don't you, you want to start with the A13 or?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What the A13 does is, for the most part, it clarifies some language for the DPS and doesn't really change the intent of the bill. It's about confirming that the Secretary of State's office, or excuse me, the county auditors and not DPS is responsible for sending out a mailing. It also deletes HHS from the bill because of a longer term question with the fiscal note.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. So I'll move the A13. Are there questions of the committee about this amendment? Okay, with that, then all those in favor signify by saying. Excuse me? Oh, Representative Kosnick.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I couldn't get the mute button going.
That's
on.
That's okay.
Could the author explain a little bit what she mentioned on the amendment and fiscal note removing HHS? Get a little clarity for that, please.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Or Representative Kosnick. Yes, so there is some, because it implicates CMS, There's some question of how the agency would implement the program. I think it's a little bit complicated by a new administration. So we just thought the cleanest thing to do was at this point remove the provision and continue talking with the agency.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the reduced impact on the fiscal cost then?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick, Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick. I believe that we never got DHS never actually submitted their fiscal note because of this ongoing piece. So I don't think it changes the fiscal note that we have seen, if that answers your question.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it must have been significant enough to offer an amendment and change that, and I was hoping that the author could speak to that, the fiscal implications. What kind of savings are you estimating then, perhaps, that we're saving on this?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Since they haven't been able to cost it out, I can't answer that question for you at this point. So I think what we think is the cleanest thing to do is just to eliminate that provision from the bill at this point and continue having the conversation.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative Kosnick?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's just interesting that, you know, one of the main concerns with this is the huge, huge cost of this bill overall. Now we're recognizing that there's a huge cost to it, so we're taking an amendment to it, but the author is not able to even ballpark what the savings of this is, but certainly recognizing that there is a significant cost in addition to significant policy changes within this bill. But I guess I would support the amendment, even knowing that we're moving in the right direction of reducing the cost of government. But this bill still has a huge, huge, significant cost. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further? Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Is there any further discussion to the A13 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
All those in favor, or all those opposed, the motion prevails. The A13 is incorporated. If you have an additional amendment, the A14, Representative Greenman, then I'll move that. And do you want to explain the A14 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, what the A14 amendment does is deletes Article 6, which pertains to transparency and redistricting. It's because the redistricting committee hasn't met yet, we're going to delete it from House File 9 and introduce it as a standalone so that it can meet that deadline.
Okay, thank you very much. And is there a discussion to the A14 amendment? Okay, I don't see any discussion. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? The A14 is incorporated into House File 9. So thank you very much, members. And to your bill, Representative Greenman. And again, members, we're going to focus on the provisions that are under that are in the R Committee's jurisdiction. And Representative Greenman, you can focus on that as well. Obviously, any questions that others have would be in order, but our focus today will be on the DVS related items. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I'm glad to be here, and I'm grateful to be presenting House File 9, the Democracy for the People Act. This bill strengthens Minnesota's best traditions of inclusive participation, sound election administration, and transparency in government. And it rests on the simple premise that our state works best when the voices of all Minnesotans are at the center of our democracy. When all Minnesotans, Black, Brown, Indigenous, White, Metro, and Greater Minnesota, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and folks with no party at all, when Minnesotans power our democracy. And so I'm going to turn it over in a second to House Research just to walk through the provisions that are under the Transportation Committee jurisdiction. But I wanted to start quickly with a background of why these provisions are important, and this is important. This year tested our democracy in unimaginable ways. We conducted a presidential election during a global pandemic, and we saw democracy tested by a rising climate of disinformation and fear. It required a heroic effort by our elections officials and Minnesota voters to protect voter access and ensure we have safe, secure, and well-run elections. 30,000 local elections officials, our friends and neighbors across the state, showed up, put their health on the line to help us conduct a safe and secure election. And thousands more pitched in to ensure that voters had the opportunity to register and participate, probably everybody on this committee. Millions of Minnesotans turned out to participate, but like in so many other areas of policy, the pandemic has also exposed the cracks, the inefficiencies, and the inequities in our system. And this bill responds to some of those. It defends and strengthens the right to vote by improving voter registration and increasing access to the ballot for every Minnesotan, no matter where they live, what their background is, or how they cast their ballot. The specific provision of House File 9 in front of the Transportation Committee today would update voter registration processes through automatic voter registration and increase access for Minnesotans, while improving election administration, our voter rolls, and the bottom line. These provisions streamline voter registration already happening when Minnesotans get a driver's license or identification card. It means that when people go apply for or renew their license, the voter the information and the for eligibility is transferred to elections officials to add or update that person's registration. It gives voters an opportunity to decline and local elections administrators the information they need to do all the checks and filters they're already doing to get folks registered. This policy would boost registration prior to Election Day and help keep our voters rolls up to date as voters regularly update their information with DVS. By increasing voter registration data entered electronically and automatically, this policy will produce less headaches for voters and also help our elections administrators save the time and money they spend on manually entering voter registration data. This policy encourages voter participation by removing yet another barrier to voter registration. These provisions will strengthen our democracy by putting Minnesotans at the center and ensuring that the voices impacted by our policy are at the table when we're making it. With that, I think it'd be helpful to turn it over to House Research, to Matt Burris, to quickly identify and walk through the sections under the transportation jurisdiction and then maybe turn it over to some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And just to give members a little bit of a map for our for this hearing, we will have Mr. Burris go through the relevant provisions for our committee. We'll have testimony and then questions of the author and testifiers. And with that, Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, the core provision that I'll point to and highlight is found in Article 1, Section 12, and this is on page 11 of the bill. And this is a change that impacts the Department of Public Safety. And as Representative Greenman outlined, this would sort of flip the process or modify the process for applications for voter registration. And the change is found primarily in subdivisions 1 and 3. Subdivision 3 deals with the Department of Public Safety's process specifically, and it would direct the department to submit data on driver's license applications that have to include information that's necessary for the voter registration process, and that data would be submitted when the applicant demonstrates citizenship. And in that set of changes, there are some revisions to the frequency as well as information and situations when the data is conveyed, requirement that information is not conveyed when a applicant doesn't show citizenship, as well as a provision on the timing of when this is implemented following confirmation of the systems with a due date of June 1st, 2022. And then following that, on page 15 of the bill, section 13 is also relates to the Department of Public Safety as well as other agencies. It's more or less a conforming change that gives direction to the department, among others, to provide information around the voter registration process.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burris. Representative Greenman, did you want to now call on your testifiers? I could as well, but maybe you might have an order that you would like, so maybe we should just have you do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Burris. Yes, could we start with Sam from Center for Secure Modern Elections?
And I'm sorry, I don't have, unfortunately, I don't have the names here. Could you, the last name would be helpful.
I'm happy to jump in. My last name is long and difficult. It's Oliker-Friedland.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Oliker-Friedland, and thank you for stating your name for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Representative Hornstein. My name is Sam Oliker-Friedland. I work for the Center for Secure and Modern Elections, where I am chief counsel. And a proud member of the Minnesota Bar. So I'm particularly excited to be here talking to you all today. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss these bills with you. CSME is an organization that works across the country on policies that make voting more secure and more efficient. Automatic voter registration, as found in House Files 9 and House Files 607, use verified information citizens are already providing to agencies that they interact with to register them to vote securely and efficiently, and is a great example of one of those policies. I'm testifying here today in support of both bills. Automatic voter registration works by keeping voter rolls up to date while also keeping ineligible voters off the rolls. It saves costs and time for government agencies who interact with eligible citizens, and it registers new voters more effectively and securely than any other registration policy. Here's how it works. I walk into a DVS office to apply for or renew a license. As part of that process, and especially as the Real ID process is rolled out, I'm already providing the information that all of the information that government officials need to identify whether I'm an eligible voter or not. So, for example, I will demonstrate my citizenship, again, as part of the Real ID or standard ID license process by, for example, providing a passport or U.S. birth certificate to identify myself to the agency. I'm also providing my residence address along with demonstration of that address and along with my age. That provides the agency what they need in a confirmed verified way to identify whether I'm an eligible voter. I want to make one flag here because some people have questions about this, which is that this process also allows us to identify ineligible voters and automatically filter them out of the registration process. So just like I might provide a passport or U.S. birth certificate if I'm a citizen, if I'm not a citizen, I might provide a green card as part of my DVS application. Upon presentation of an indication that I'm not an eligible voter, these folks will be automatically filtered out of the automatic voter registration process. All DVS needs to do is identify which clients submitted this requisite information to identify them as eligible voters in DVS. Will transfer that information securely and electronically to election officials who will provide the eligible citizen an opportunity to opt out of voter registration, register them to vote if they do not opt out, and update existing voter registration records. This process saves money. I was sort of interested in Representative Kosnick's comment at the beginning of the hearing about how interested you all are in, I suspect, saving money for your agencies. And for the state of Minnesota as a whole, our estimates find that processing a paper application for election officials in terms of staff time, document retention, et cetera, can cost upwards of $4 for a single application, whereas processing an electronic application, such as an AVR application, can cost 35 cents. 22 states and the District of Columbia have already enacted automatic voter registration. These states are as wide a variety as West Virginia, Utah, New Mexico, Michigan. They have all sort of worked to securely and efficiently keep their voter rolls up to date and register more voters. And we strongly encourage Minnesota to join those 22 states and enact automatic voter registration. I will be here for this hearing to answer any specific questions you might have about how the process works, how other states have found the process, or trends that we see across the country in automatic voter registration policy. Thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Alaker-Friedland, and we will, and I see Representative Olson has a question. What we're gonna do is we're gonna hear from Mr. Dean and Sean Lim, and then we'll have questions for the author and testifiers. So I did find my list of testifiers, and so next on my list is Michael Dean from Lead, Minnesota. Mr. Dean, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Great, thank you very much. Chair Hornstein, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dean, and I'm the executive director of Lead Minnesota. We represent the 180,000 students attending Minnesota's community and technical colleges. I'm here in support of the automatic voter registration provisions of House File 9. Our democracy depends on the knowledgeable, public-spirited, and engaged citizens. Minnesota's community colleges and universities are not just teaching institutions, they're also institutions with a responsibility to support the development of the skills needed for participation in our democracy. When a young person turns 16, we don't expect them to automatically know how to drive. The same applies to when a young person becomes 18. They don't magically get pixie dust spread on them and become an engaged citizen. It's something that must be learned. And the act of voting is often the first step that young people take to become engaged members of our community. In many states, that road to participation is riddled with barriers that stop young people from voting. In Minnesota, we've worked hard to reduce those barriers, and this is one of the reasons why we have the highest voting rates for young people across the country. But our voter registration process is still a barrier for many young people in Minnesota, where bad handwriting, typos, or administrative errors can be the difference between feeling empowered by voting your first election or being rejected because you made some small mistake. It's time that we modernize our voter registration process. Minnesota should join the 22 other states for a more secure, accurate, and cost-effective process to manage voter registrations in Minnesota. Thank you very much for your time today.
And thank you, Mr. Dean. Our next testifier is Sean Lim from the Minnesota Youth Collaborative.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the Transportation Committee for having me. My name is Sean Lim. I'm 21 years old and currently serving as the lead campus organizer for the nonprofit Minnesota Youth Collective. And I'm here today to testify in favor of AVR within Representative Greenman's comprehensive House File 9, in addition to Representative Bonner's standalone AVR bill, House File 607. So, as an electoral youth and community organizer, I've been registering my neighbors and fellow Minnesotans to vote in local, city, state, and federal elections since before I could even vote myself. And I have provided students and Minnesotans aged 18 to 36 with the tools and knowledge that they need to participate in our elections. And so I firmly believe that AVR will set the foundational groundwork for an increase in voter turnout, regardless of party, by dismantling numerous existing roadblocks to democratic participation. I am a strong proponent of AVR because it would, as the name implies, automatically register young voters to be able to cast their ballot when they turn 18. And it would save the state a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of resources over time to ensure a robust and more accessible democracy. I know that it would certainly make the job of grassroots organizers like me easier and greatly increase turnout. In our state, which already enjoys the highest turnout in the country, AVR furthermore allows 16 and 17-year-olds to pre-register to vote, empowering young people to be set and ready the moment they turn 18. And I'm excited about what this means for high schoolers and the fostering of youth civic engagement in our state. It is proven through research that folks who participate in the first election that they're eligible for are more consistently likely to vote every other election for the rest of their lives. And so that aside, logistically, the back-end AVR is proven to be the most effective policy to add eligible voters to the rolls and securely update rolls and voter lists with accurate address information. It is safe, it is efficient, and it is seamless. And this is great for the thousands of young college students and renters that I've engaged on campus who are highly mobile. They move from freshman dorms to apartments to homes every year and work multiple jobs. So AVR eliminates the arduous process of manual data entry for state employees. To tie up all of these points, AVR is secure. It automatically eliminates any duplicate records, making voter systems more efficient to manage. As other testifiers have said, it costs approximately $3.64 to process each paper form, compared to around 35 cents for an electronic submission. So it will save invaluable time, millions of taxpayer dollars, and reinforce election security when we do away with paper forms and transition over to AVR. Right now, 23 states plus DC have already implemented AVR or are in the process of implementing it. And I sincerely hope that we can make Minnesota the next. And because of this, I urge all of you and your colleagues to support this legislation. Thank you so much for your time and consideration, and I yield back.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work at the Minnesota Youth Collective. Very appreciated. And members, I have questions, and I'll call on members in the order that I saw the hands raised. And again, these are questions of the author and of any testifiers. So the order will be Representative Olson, followed by Representative Petersburg, and then Representative Cagle and others. Representative Olson.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two real quick questions, and the first one would be regarding, are there any legal ramifications to having minors being opted into a program that they would have to electively opt out of? That's kind of one question. I don't know if there's anything wrong with that. I know when I was a teacher, the students didn't really have the ability to, they didn't have the legal ability to opt in or opt out. It was their parents who would do that for them. And then the last question would be, if I was registered as a student based off of my license and my home address, and then I go off to college. Now, when I was in college, I voted based off of where my college was at, and I was able to register to vote that day at the university and then vote there. Would that require me to do the exact same thing, which is change my registration? And is that really fixing the issue, or is that just adding another issue with that? So I don't know who to direct those two questions to.
Let's start with Representative Greenman, and I know that she has both testifiers and others that have expertise in this from who haven't testified that are available to testify. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson. So on the first question, which I think you were asking, I don't want to go out on a limb on the legal question. If either House Counsel has a thought on that, it might be something I have to get back to you on, or if the Secretary of State's office has a thought.
Okay, well, we do have Sam Bonowitz available. Sam could take a shot at that, and we also have Mr. Burris as well.
Chair, members, Sam Bonowitz, Director of Government Relations with the Office of the Secretary of State. I would defer to House Counsel on this, but we have seen registration for 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds in other states. And that has not been an issue in those states, but I would defer to House Counsel.
Thank you, Ms. Bonowitz. Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair and members, in checking with my colleague, we'll have to look into it and get back to you. Sorry, don't know that offhand.
Okay, and then I think Representative Olson had a second question. Around the issue of processes for instant or same day registration on college campuses. So maybe we could answer that one as well. Representative Greenman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I understood your question, so if folks are pre-registered, they actually aren't their registration doesn't become active until they're 18. But if I understand your question, it is, will folks still, if they move and and want to vote somewhere else, they will have to register and vote at their new residence. Lots of folks decide to vote from home as well, so it sort of gives them the option. I think that one thing about this, and this the pre-registration isn't in front of us today, but one thing that we have heard is that the other states, red states and blue states that have adopted it, have really done it because when folks are 16 and 17, when they're in high school, when they're living at home, it's actually the perfect time for folks to get registered and to really get in the system and some of that education. And so it's really based on that. So yes, if you move, you have to re-register like anyone else would. But that, I think, is the answer to your question.
Representative Olson, did you have any follow-up or comment?
Yeah, that just real quick. So when I was I didn't have to actually change my license when I went to university. I just went there and was able to vote. Will that affect my – if I pre-register, go off to college, will that affect my abilities? Or do I not have to change my license? And will I still be able to vote at my college campus without having to change my residency? That's a question.
Representative Greenman, and then we'll move on to Representative Petersburg.
Yes, I think if I followed your question, and it doesn't change at all the rules around when and when you don't have to update your driver's license. And so I think that the answer to your question is yes.
Thank you very much for your questions, Representative Olson. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to make sure I clarify with you, where is this going from here?
This is going to higher education.
Okay.
And we have another bill with the same language, which will go to state government finance.
Mr. Chair, I would first of all like to request a roll call on this bill.
Okay. Roll call will happen.
And then the other question, because I want to make sure that I'm on the same page with the author of this, too. I've heard quite a few testifiers talk about how this bill is going to reduce the barriers to voters. For that, is that kind of the gist of why we're adding this language?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just note, I think this is our fourth committee stop. And so we have a few more left to go, but happy to be here. The purpose of this provision is it reduces the burdens on voters, it reduces the burdens on elections administrators, and I think it also reduces the burdens on DPS frontline staff who are currently required to as part of law, to affirmatively offer registration. This would mean that would take the information that's already being collected as part of the transaction. It would automatically, for folks who have verified citizenship, send it to the Secretary of State. So I think reducing the burdens on the whole system, voters, elections administrators, and DVS, is part of the intent of the provision.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And that's kind of what confuses me, because I don't see the fact that you have an application for your driver's license and a box on it to check. How come that becomes such a burden? Because that allows the same process to occur. It allows electronically filing for an application for registering for voters, all that other stuff. It's just that it requires, when you fill out your application, to just check the box. And so I certainly don't understand how that becomes overwhelming. It still allows for the same savings. It allows for all of these things. I don't see the need for it to be automatic when the automatic portion of it also becomes a challenge when there's a change of address or there's a change of locations. All that has to be also worked through the system as well. So it seems to me that the affirmative action of persons when they fill out their application is much more or less cumbersome for the department, actually, than the automatic that has to keep track of everything. So, I mean, can you help me understand how the fact that checking a box is more overburdensome than anything else?
Representative Greenman.
So let me start with the voter, because when I went and did my new driver's license, I actually almost missed the box. And so the first thing is, you know, when folks are providing all the information that you already need to register to vote, and it is taken and it is automatically screened, sending along those folks who have verified citizenship. And then folks actually get a mailing. The mailing that you get when you register to vote will have an opportunity to decline. And so that comes all the way through. So I think that is less burdensome for voters. It means less voters are going to actually just miss it. The last time that I was at DVS, I waited for a long time, and I was ready to get in and get out. And so I think when it comes to voters, when it comes to elections administrators, and I can let me start as a policymaker, but I think I'm going to turn it over to the Secretary of State's office. It does a few things. One, it saves some of the data entry and the deciphering of handwriting. And it also, and this is where the DVS frontline staff comes in, it also means that, there is an affirmative obligation of our DVS staff to ask folks for that opportunity to register and that to make sure that I at least see that box. And it's not always happening. And part of it is because it's part of 100 other things they're doing. This way, when folks provide the information that they need to provide, it is automatically transmitted. It goes to the county, the Secretary of State, and then the counties. And they do all the same checks that they do if someone submitted a paper registration. It allows us to start moving towards, away from paper, and towards a system that will be more cost effective. It'll reduce errors. And all the other things. I do want to maybe turn it over to the Secretary of State's office if they have anything to add. You are the experts. So, Mr. Chair, if I could turn it over to Sam Bonowitz.
Sure. Is Ms. Bonowitz still with us?
Yes. Hi, Chair, members. I think Representative Greenman did a pretty good overview of why this helps clean up some of those voter rolls and make them even more accurate and make it remove some of those barriers for voters. Just as an example, in 2018, over 130,000 eligible Minnesotans registered to vote on election day using a valid Minnesota driver's license, a Minnesota ID, or receipt of one of those with a current address. With Representative Greenman's bill, many of these would have been previously registered before election day. So that is just another kind of data point, an example for how that would make it a little bit easier for Minnesota voters.
Thank you, Ms. Bonowitz. Representative Petersburg, and then Mr. Representative Greenman, I think one of your other testifiers maybe you wanted to answer. I wanted to see if that was to this. Mr. Lim, is this, did you want to, I see your hand up. Did you want to?
In response to Representative Petersburg, I will also add that not everyone drives a car, right? Not everyone has a permit in the state. Not everyone has a license. And so, for someone to have to go to, DVS to be able to vote or miss the paper form or not have access to a computer at home. You know, this solves a lot of accessibility issues for young people as well. A lot of people are busy on campus, and with AVR, I wouldn't have to be out on the street canvassing people, reminding them to register to vote ahead of the election deadlines and stuff like that.
Representative Petersburg, thank you for that. Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. So again, if we're now going through the vehicle driver's license program and we're allowing this up to other programs, there's going to be some redundancy in some of that, as well as some discussions about who's going to go through the systems to find out if they've already registered or not registered, or are we just going to duplicate all of that particular service? And I think I heard questions about, well, handwriting is going to be an issue. Well, if you're doing it through the driver's license system or other systems, handwriting is the same no matter what. And so I'm still unclear as how checking a box is a barrier to voting. It doesn't make sense to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. When I go to DVS, just kind of in response to what Representative Petersburg said, I'm there to decipher my own handwriting. When you fill out a voter registration form, you mail it in, and you're not there to let people know how awful your E or A is. So, but this question was actually to DPS or DVS about what the current process looks like, and then how do you see this as really kind of assisting, or how would this work in practicality at the driver's license? stations, I guess.
Is there anyone from DVS on the call that could answer this question?
Or maybe the author knows.
Representative Greenman?
Yeah, well, so I can take a crack, and I can't get too technical. As somebody has the experience that you do, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kegel. So currently, and I think as we talked about with Representative Petersburg, right now there is a state law requires DPS and other state agencies to affirmatively offer voter registration. I think what this does, and again, to sort of as we think about both reducing the burden on the frontline staff and on how they work, is it allows them to take information, again, they're already collecting, focus on the work that they're doing, and then sort of as part of the back end, I'd call it data processing, send it to the Secretary of State, who then takes it from there and really focuses with the counties on how they put folks on the rolls like they do. I also just want to speak to the issues of redundancies, because this is actually one of the reasons for this bill. When you talk to elections administrators and some of the folks on the some of the testifiers and some of the folks in the Secretary of State's office and state who can speak much more detailed to the how much time they spend making sure that we have good, clean voter rolls. This is actually one way to do it, right? Because you're updating information more regularly when folks go and update their driver's licenses. Many folks who will actually end up benefiting from this are folks who are already on the registration rolls. And this will allow them to update their registration and the Secretary of State and county auditors to make that change without having multiple redundancies. The paper process that Mr. Lynn talked about, which is really important to how we reach people, is also one way that the county folks spend a lot of time just making sure that we don't have redundancies. So I just wanted to make sure that was part of the conversation.
Thank you very much. I have anything else, Representative Kegel?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, so to me, this just sounds like it's more of a data sharing. It's really kind of making sure that everybody who has the correct data is getting the correct data.
Did you want to comment, Representative Greenman, or?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, what it's about is, thank you, Mr. Chair, voters are providing this information, and it is the information folks need to be able to register. And we're still going to give folks an opportunity to decline registration, but it means that when we are providing information, we'll automatically be put in the system. I would remind folks that there's actually a state, North Dakota next door, doesn't even have voter registration. And so this is a way that we can just make registration as seamless as possible, make the data as seamless as possible for our agencies, and ensure that everybody who wants to be able to vote can vote.
Okay, Representative Elkins, and then we have a couple more. We have several more questions, and I'd like to move things along. So we'll go with Representative Elkins, Mason, Torkelson, and Kosnick, and then we'll proceed to discuss and vote on the bill at that point. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, just real quick. So Representative Bonner, who will be presenting next, and I met with DVS personnel about a week ago and learned that, you know, there's already a very close integration between the DVS systems and the Secretary of State systems, and we already regularly feed change of address type information and voter registration information from the DVS systems to the Secretary of State system. So, but, you know, if Ms. Bonner was to just confirm that for, you know, or somebody from DVS, I see several DVS people on the call who are familiar with this process as well, is that this would in fact just be a relatively easy change to make to the existing integration between the DVS system and the Secretary of State systems.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Ms. Bonowitz, or again, anyone from DVS?
Chair, members, we do already have this data sharing with DPS. DPS transmits the information to the Secretary of State daily, which then makes it available to the county election staff in the statewide voter registration database. So this is already a process that that is established and happens daily.
Thank you. Ms. Fassbender, did you want to comment on this?
Correct. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Fassbender. I'm the Driver Services Director, and I just wanted to also confirm that our current process, it wouldn't change it very much due to the automatic voter registration. We would still be collecting the data and electronically transferring it to the Secretary of State.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I tend to be really cautious on opt-out items. And for this one in particular, I wanted to clarify something. If you check the box and say it is somebody that has been in a correctional facility, and normally they're not allowed to vote until a certain point, if they would, in, and there seems to be a lot of confusion about this, that's why I'm asking the question. If somebody checks a box in good faith and you found out that, no, indeed, they still aren't eligible to vote, would they be in danger of being arrested for fraud or anything? And I think one of the testifiers went over this point really quickly, but I just wanted to make sure we're clear on it.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mason. So the first thing I just say, and this is not in front of this committee, but one of the reasons, one of the important reasons that we also want to restore the right to vote is because if somebody is there in front of you in our community, then they can be registered to vote. But this can work independently too, because for two reasons. One is there's no box to check. And so the information is going to the Secretary of State, and they run all the checks that they currently do on eligibility. And so it actually sort of wouldn't look much different than it currently does now. What it does do is say, and we don't want to, whether it's somebody who is ineligible because they're in guardianship or the situation you ran up, we don't want the operation of government to put anybody at risk. And so we have the checks to ensure that that happens, but we also want to make sure that that if, you know, this happens by operation of data, we'll catch that, and then two, it will be it won't be considered a registration because nobody has affirmatively done the work.
Thank you very much for that answer. And then our last two questions will come in this order, from Representative Torkelson and then Representative Koznick. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the testifiers stated that a small handwriting error could cause a person to be unable to vote. Perhaps the author can explain exactly how that might happen.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson. I'm going to turn it over to the Secretary of State. I'm not sure I caught the reference, but what I would say is, and I've seen this happen, is if you have a small handwriting error and you are entered into the database in the wrong way, you may show up and they may not have you entered. I am going to turn it over to I think, Sam Bonowitz, just to clarify or to make sure that I'm giving you good, accurate information.
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair, members, Representative Greenman, again, gave a pretty good overview. You can easily imagine a situation where somebody mistakenly, misses letters or numbers, and then they end up being challenged maybe on the roster, or they're entered improperly into the statewide voter registration system. So when they show up to the polling place, they are unaware. They can't find them in the polling place roster. So you can imagine those two hurdles if numbers are transposed or letters are transposed.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but doesn't the same day registration
either Representative Greenman or Ms. Bonowitz?
I think you cut out a little bit, but I think you asked it, does same day registration help with that? Absolutely, and same day registration is an important fail-safe, and this doesn't change that at all. What this does do is help us to get more accurate, cleaner voter rolls, and so we avoid less of those issues to begin with.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. There are further questions, but I know you're running out of time, so I'll drop out.
Okay, well, if you had one more, I think we've got time for that, but we can return to it in the discussion if you'd like. Representative Koznick for our last member question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is going back to the fiscal cost. So I understand that there isn't not a fiscal note because I can't find one and, or I'm unable to use my computer very well right now. And my notes suggest a pretty significant cost in this. Could maybe Mr. Lee discuss the fiscal note or the cost implications on this bill for us, please?
Mr. Lee to the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, certainly. So the fiscal note that I was looking at was a preliminary note drafted for an earlier version of the bill when it was at an earlier committee stop. So it's not the fiscal note that would be requested after if the committee acts on this bill and the bill gets re-engrossed, then the new note would show the impacts to the changes in the A13 and A14 amendments. But very briefly, particular to the transportation bill area jurisdictions, there are impacts relating to, pulling up the fiscal note here now, relating to DPS and driver and vehicle services. The total cost to the driver services fund was estimated to be about $492,000 in fiscal 2022 and $383,000 in fiscal 2023. And that's before the A3 amendment that would have changed those costs a little bit. And some of the components of those transportation-related costs are, one, $64,000 programming cost, and two, a $383,000 postage cost to notify people of the opt-out provision. My understanding is that the change in the A13 amendment would move that opt-out notification cost away from DPS and to, I believe, the Secretary of State. And I could be wrong on that one, but I'm pretty sure that's that would be the change. So I can't speak to a fiscal note that isn't completed yet. It's requested, but I would imagine that there probably still DBS might still recognize a programming cost.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman, you are nodding your head, so I'll ask you to comment. And I see Representative Bonner. As well, but why don't we have Representative Greenman comment and then Representative Koznick if you have a follow-up.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Koznick. And I think the conversation about the amendment only addressed one of the pieces. Actually, the reason that one of the pieces of the amendment was actually just clarifying that DPS, it was never intended that DPS would have to send out the notice that they then costed out. It was always intended, but I think that one of the things that was explained to us in this committee process was the language was a little unclear. And so what one of the things the amendment does is just clarify that the notice that includes the opt-out is actually on the Secretary of State. It's a mailing that they already do when folks are registered. And so that's the reduction. I think that the programming costs will still end up there and are probably actually important for no matter how we decide to end up doing registration. But I just wanted to clarify that. That is different than the conversation we had about the HHS cost.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Freeman. I appreciate the clarification, Mr. Lee, that was helpful to understand. But the testifiers have suggested that this bill somehow saves us money, and it may be an automatic registration, and we might then consider automatic registration as soon as you get a valid birth certificate. But it's not correct that this bill will save the state of Minnesota money. This is a monstrosity of an elections bill that'll cost the general fund, according to my notes, about $18 million, the Secretary of State's office, $2 million, and the Campaign Finance Board, $16 million a year with welfare for politicians in this bill. And so aside from the transportation and the DBS components that the amendment spoke to, it was a testifier had suggested that we do already have one of the highest voter turnouts, but the true intent, I might suggest, is that it saves progressive groups time and effort and registering voters automatically for them. And so we can't support this bill with these huge significant policy changes and significant costs to the taxpayers. So I appreciate your efforts, but the we're just simply going to have a very different approach to our election systems, where I think it's incumbent on individuals to take the responsibility to simply register to vote. Is not too much to ask to make sure that voters understand the responsibility that comes with participating in our representative democracy. So I will be voting no to this huge, huge bill. Thank you.
And Representative Bonner, I know you were going to get to your bill in just a couple minutes. I don't know if you want to make your points then might be appropriate, but I know you've been waving your hand, and if you have a quick comment, we can
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to jump in because I think it's relevant here to this particular discussion. First of all, to the fiscal note, and I know this committee is confined to the provisions around the Department of Public Safety. I had extensive conversations about that fiscal note. And yes, the amendment does in fact clarify that that opt-out notice will be part of the regular notice that goes out to voters. What typically happens is when you're registered to vote, one of two things will happen. You will go through a robust system of checks and balances. You will be determined that you are in fact eligible to vote, and you'll receive a notice in the mail that says, congratulations, you're registered to vote, and here's your precinct. And it will contain the language that allows for that opt-out, or you will receive a notice that says you are not eligible to vote and politely remind you that it is in fact a felony to do so. So
thank you, Representative Bonner, thank you. We're gonna get to your provision, and if you, I think it might be just a little bit better if you could talk about it when we have your bill up.
Okay.
So thank you for that clarification. Is there any further discussion of House File 9 as amended? Any further discussion? Okay, members, Representative Weedman, did you want to conclude with any final comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. This, as I said, I think this will be, we're going on 5 hours of testimony and discussion on this bill, and I think it's really important. This is about the most important thing that we're doing here, which is ensuring that Minnesota voters are at the center of our democracy and that our policymaking reflects Minnesotans across the state. And I will just say, this is an investment. These policies are not partisan. They're not bipartisan. They're nonpartisan. Many of them, like AVR, which we've seen in 22 other states, and I am excited and happy to talk about the whole bill. What I will say is the cost is a very small down payment in the infrastructure of our democracy. In the 4 hours we've been doing testimony, Jeff Bezos has made $36 million, and I think $36 million in the whole provision. And to be clear, that's not just AVR. That includes provisions that put democracy dollars like the PCR in the hands of Minnesota voters. It's a provision that protects the right to vote and protects elections officials. That is a small investment in the 3.3 million Minnesota voters who turned out in 2020 and the 5.7 million Minnesotans that we are sent here to represent. So I am really grateful for this conversation today. I know that we can, that our democracy has been tested and that we have challenges ahead, but I also know in Minnesota, we've been here before and we can tackle big challenges when we do it together. So I'd ask for your support, and I look forward to continuing the conversation in a few more committees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 9, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education. And Mr. Dodge, if you could take the roll, please.
Chair Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Vice Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, nay. Representative Barr?
No.
Barr, nay. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick? Representative Frederick? Representative Hausman?
Aye.
Hausman, aye. Representative Heinrich?
No.
Heinrich, nay. Representative Kosmic?
No.
Kosmic, nay. Representative Mason?
Mason, aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Murphy?
Murphy, aye.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
No.
Olson, nay. Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Torkelson?
No.
Torkelson, nay. Representative West?
West, no.
West, nay. There are 9 ayes and 7 nays.
Hey, thank you very much, Representative Greenman. House File 9 as amended is on its way to the Higher Ed Committee. And now we have members, just to clarify, we have an identical version of this bill that we just voted on, but it is a standalone version, and it will be going to the Committee on State Government Finance. And this is from Representative Bonner. So, Representative Bonner, you can speak to your bill. Just one second here. I need to. Sorry, folks. I'm
607.
Okay, thank you. House File 607 is before us, and I will move it to the Committee on State Government. So, Representative Bonner, I know that you wanted to make some comments as well. You were in the process of those, and I wanted to get our vote in for House File 9. So, if you want to present your bill, you can.
Mr. Chair, if it makes sense, we should move the A2 first, and I can speak to what that is and make that clarification.
Sure. Why don't we do that? I will move the A2 amendment, Representative Bonner.
All right. Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. And I'll briefly just 10,000 foot view. Essentially, this clarifies and cleans up some language after discussion with research. It does clarify what I had started to mention earlier, that the onus for that opt-out notice actually goes away from DPS. So all of that will come off of the fiscal note, which leaves a remaining $64,000 in potential programming costs on the DPS side. However, in conversations with DPS and FAST, which is the vendor that maintains the system, there's also a strong possibility that $64,000 will actually be absorbed into the current ongoing maintenance budget for that application. Which in essence, if that were to happen, would essentially bring the cost related to DPS down to zero. For the fiscal note, we have requested an update based on the A2.
Okay, is there a discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, we'll incorporate that. Representative Bonner, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. We have House File 607 as amended before us. Representative Bonner.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There is one point on which I'm certain we all agree. Safe, secure, and fair elections are the cornerstone of our democratic process. Minnesota has had the distinction of having the highest voter turnout in the nation consistently, with nearly 80% of eligible voters participating. An honor we would like to maintain. That said, as many of you know, my background includes a strong focus on process improvement. It is not enough to claim to be beacons of democracy, but we must live our values by continually working to increase participation while balancing the checks and balances it requires. The bill before you does just that. A simple bill, really. It keeps the robust features employed by DPS every day while it processes driver's license and Minnesota ID cards. It has the same checks and verifications for identity and documentation required every day. This bill improves access for legally eligible voters by making one simple switch. It moves from an opt-out to an opt-in methodology. Why does that give us a more robust system than today? First, it meets the goal of maintaining Minnesota's position as a leader in the nation by starting with the assumption that every eligible legal voter should be registered and counted. It increases the number of individuals entering the process who go through those robust checks. In our case, the remaining 20% of eligible voters, including verifying their name, address, and eligibility, meaning the voter rolls on election day are clean and accurate. It reduces the need for same-day registration, as the vast majority of legal eligible voters have already been carefully vetted on the front end, reducing same-day registrants to a mere fraction. It eases the burden on poll workers during peak times on election day, decreases wait times in high-traffic precincts. We are at a tipping point, with nearly half of the U.S. instituting this common-sense approach from red states, blue states, and purple states. By simply opting in and employing these robust checks and balances, we provide accurate voter rolls for safe, secure elections over and above our already strong electoral system.
Thank you so much, Representative Bonner, and members. Again, we just, Representative Petersburg, quick question, and I know we had the almost exact language here, so previously, but Representative Petersburg, it's certainly appropriate to ask a question of the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, the comments I'm going to make would be the very similar, so I'm not going to restate those, but in quite a few different times, you talked about this being an opt-in system program. Actually, the system we currently have is opt-in. This one is an opt-out, because you would have to exercise your option of going out. So this isn't an opt-in. This is just an automatic if you wanted to exercise any other choice, you'd have to be an opt-out. So that's kind of clarification. And what I find very interesting is talking about how we lead the United States, including those states that already have automatic voter registration, how we're leading them with voter turnout with the current system. And so it's something to ponder. But Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to say that I cannot support this bill either at this time, and that I would request a roll call.
Thank you. Well, we're going to take a roll call at any rate, but I will certainly call the roll if there is no further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you for Representative Bonner. Some very quick concluding comments.
Thank you. Just to be clear, you know, I think that the difference here is really that we're making the presumption to default to that every eligible legal voter should actually go through the same registration process that they go to today when they check the box. What we're really talking about here is including the remaining 20% that do not currently vote today into our process. And when we asked earlier about it saving money, if we do the estimates, about 130,000 people did same-day registration in 2018. I don't have the figures for 2020. But if we cost that out at the lower cost of $3.50 per registration, that's about $455,000. If we significantly reduce that, or if we went to an automatic system and that now costs us 35 cents, that's a savings of $410,000. So not only does it actually streamline the process, it makes sure that we vetted each and every registrant here in the state so that we know they are eligible and legal voters. It's got nice, clean rolls, and it saves us money. So, it, you know, just to be clear, this is not something that is unique to Minnesota. It's not unique to red states or blue states or purple states. It's everybody that is experiencing this. And it just makes good common sense to continue to evolve into a good, solid process that is efficient and streamlined.
Well, thank you for that, Representative Bonner. And so I will now renew my motion that House File 607, as amended, be referred to the State Government Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Vice Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, nay. Representative Barr?
No.
Barr, nay. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hausman?
Aye.
Hausman, aye. Representative Heinrich?
No.
Heinrich, nay. Representative Kosmic?
No.
Kosmic, nay. Representative Mason?
Aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
No.
Olson, nay. Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Torkelson?
No.
Torkelson, nay. Representative West?
West, no.
West, nay. There are 10 ayes and 7 nays.
Thank you, members. And with that, House File 607 as amended is on its way to the State Government Finance Committee. Members, in our remaining time, we have two policy bills from agencies, and I have had a conversation with Representative Petersburg on this, and we're going to hear these bills. The agencies will make brief presentations on them. We'll entertain some questions, but our intention is to hold them today in the committee. We will not take votes today. There are, again, I think a couple of questions, a couple of issues with each of these bills that we want to address. And if we need to vote on them separately before deadline, we'll do that next week. There's also a possibility we could just incorporate them in our omnibus bill as well. So we'll make that decision. But today it's just really to hear the bills and get some of your questions answered. So the first bill is House File 1379, Representative Cagle. And this is a policy bill from MnDOT. And Representative Cagle, we will hear your bill and lay it over for possible inclusion in something else. Or lay it over and address it next week or possibly include it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1379 is the MnDOT agency bill. Their Section 1 has to do with Route 96, turned back to Washington County. Section 2 is in Indian Employment Services. Section 3 has to do with escort vehicles, modifying escort vehicle mandates. Section 4 is debt services forecast and shifting the due date to April 1st. And then Section 5 is effective date. And then there's a couple other turnbacks in the bill as well. And so with that, I will turn it over to my testifier, John Dukic.
Mr. Dukic, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, John Dukic with MnDOT Government Affairs. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Cagle for authoring this bill and for you, Mr. Chair, for taking the time today to hear it in committee. As Representative Cagle mentioned, this is our technical bill. It addresses several policies to help streamline operations and increase efficiencies in state government. As Representative Cagle mentioned, Section 1 of the bill returns a segment of Highway 96 back to Washington County. Section 2 includes language related to our Indian employment preferences, which permits MnDOT to implement an Indian employment preference for projects on or near an Indian reservation. Section 3 of the bill makes a small change to language regarding pilot escort vehicles for overdimensional loads. The change here is needed to ensure that in addition to a lead licensed peace officer, lead and rear escort vehicles are required when any part of an overdimensional load crosses the center line on an undivided highway. And Section 4 of the bill simply moves the due date surcharge report from March 1st to April 1st. And Section 5 makes permanent our construction manager general contractor delivery method, which is currently capped at 4 projects annually or 10 projects in total. And this is one procurement method in our toolbox, and it works particularly well for projects that are are risky or have a high degree of are highly complex. And then finally, section 6 and 7 provide for turnbacks in Murray and Martin counties, respectively. And that, Mr. Chair, concludes the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dukic. And I have questions from Representative Petersburg and Representative Torkelson. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just two questions or two areas that I think are problematic. One revolves around the Indian preference, indigenous preference issue, which I don't have a problem with per se. It's the language, and I understand that it's copied from the federal directive, but it's so nebulous, it's almost impossible to really interpret what it means to say within a day's driving distance, because first of all, it doesn't say that the individual is getting preference to actually live in that particular reservation. They could be living in a different reservation. And if you use that kind of parameters, virtually the entire state is within a certain driving distance of a reservation. So it seems to me that it would be better for us to just pick a mileage. 50 miles is what we use up here at the Capitol for various things. Why not just do that rather than using that particular language? Then I have a question about the contract language as well, sir.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. So in terms of your question, did you want to direct that to anyone in particular,
yeah.
Mr. Dukic?
Yes, please. If okay. Mr. Dukic could say why they're using that language and why not just use a particular mileage so it's easier to administer.
Sure, Mr. Chair,
Dukic.
Representative Petersburg, to address your question, I guess first off, we work with the tribes on an individual basis to determine what that mileage should be, with a typical range between 45 and 60 miles. And you're right that it's not specified in federal statute. And so we, you know, based on recommendation from council, did not want to put a stipulation or range in statute, as I said, because we work with the tribes to determine what that range should be. And it's primarily based on geographical location. And so, as an example, Grand Portage might require folks to drive further from work than the Fond du Lac tribe, which is closer to an urban area, and therefore requiring less travel. And so we try to work with the tribes on an individual level to make sure that we're doing what works well for them as well as the agency.
Thank you, Mr. Dukic. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I'll just add a comment to this, and then I'll ask my other question. And that is, but it doesn't have language indicating the employee that's getting the preference, whether or not they have to be from the reservation that you're determining the distance from. So it may be something you want to work on into the future. My other question goes back to the CMGC contract pieces, where this is going to eliminate any kind of parameters, any kind of direction. And I think the legislature, at least, is still concerned about the outcome, at least I am, about the outcome of some of these projects and some of the appearance of over budget that they are running. And I understand a lot of that has to do with the complexity and preliminary budgets versus final budgets. But it still seems like we're still dealing with some issues in which it's difficult for people to actually bid into these contracts because of their experience and so forth. And it seems like there still needs to be a little work. So eliminating that 10 limit rather than just extending it for another 4 or 5 projects may not be the best for us to do at this particular time. We certainly can work with the department and say, okay, we can extend it for another year or 2 years or another biennium as well. But I'm concerned about just eliminating it altogether until it has really been vetted out with past programs. And if Mr. Dukic could respond to that.
Mr. Dukic, and members, Representative Petersburg had raised this issue with me and the previous issue that he spoke to. And so we're going to, you know, see if there's some ways these issues can be addressed here in the intervening time before we move the bill out of committee. But quickly, Mr. Dukic.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, thank you for the question. And the reason we're looking at removing the The 10 project limit is we are approaching that limit currently. I think we're at 8 projects. And this is just something we think works well for the agency, and you don't want to lose the ability to continue to do in the future. We typically do one or two projects like this per year, but are open certainly to discussing with you and others how to make it work well for everyone.
Thank you very much. Representative Torkelson.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is also for Mr. Dukic and regarding this CMGC change. It's my understanding that it's, while you have stated it, it's convenient for the agency, that it's quite controversial among contractors. So have you polled the contractors involved with this to see what they have to say about the process and whether or not it can be improved?
Mr. Dukic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I didn't catch the very last part of your question. It kind of cut off.
I think it's just, I think Representative Torkelson was saying, have you polled or been in contact with the contractors regarding this provision?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, we have been in touch with contractors and continue conversations with them on this provision.
Representative Torkelson?
Well, I'm glad to hear that. This open-ended permission to just continue with this program unchecked, I think, is premature. It is controversial and does need to be analyzed carefully by the legislature and the contractors and the agency. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dukic.
Thank you. And Representative Torkelson, that is one of the reasons we're, you know, going to give this a little bit more time and not vote today. However, we do have an A1 amendment that we will vote on today, and that was posted in the allowed time by rule. So, Representative Cagle, did you want to explain the A1 amendment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I believe the A1, let me see if I have a million tabs open here, so it looks like
I know the feeling.
I don't have that tab open, but I believe it's just it has to. Maybe Mr. Dukic could speak to it. I can't find it.
Yeah,
here it is. It changes an effective date. So
a very very technical amendment, but sometimes technical amendments have a lot of meaning. So Mr. Dukic,
what A1.
The A1.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, this is a technical amendment that simply updates, you know, the CGMC proposal changes the effective date in one section of statute, and this was just inadvertently left off, but it concerns the same CMGC proposal, updating the effective date in a couple of areas of statute that were inadvertently left off.
Okay, so members, I mean, this doesn't necessarily affect the earlier. I mean, it does relate to the issue that we are still holding on to, but it's just Representative Torkelson. It's just it may be a little bit more controversial than a technical amendment. So, Representative Torkelson.
Well, yeah, to the same issue, Mr. Chair, it is more than just a little technical change. It opens up the back end completely. There, it removes the sunset, which then instates this program into perpetuity. That's quite a major change.
Right. So maybe Representative Cagle, you know, we're holding this bill just to see if we can flesh out some of the issues that have been raised on this, the contractor's concerns. So maybe we could maybe address the amendment when we take a look at the bill again. That might be the best way to go. I just wanted to make sure that people saw the amendment and we had a chance to go through it a little bit today. Would that be okay, Representative Cagle?
That would be completely fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So Representative Cagle is, we're not, withdraws the A1. We're going to still have it on the table for the broader discussion that we're going to have. And I don't see any more questions or comments. So again, we're laying over this House file, and I appreciate the comments that were made about, I believe, Section 5, and we will revisit those at a later date. Thank you very much, Vice Chair Cagle, and I'm going to hand over the virtual gavel to you, and then we'll take up the DBS policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it looks like you have House File 964, and the motion is to lay this over. It looks like there is an author's amendment. Did you want to move that now?
So thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I do think the A1 amendment is a technical amendment. However, there is a reason why I don't want to raise it today, and that is this was posted or circulated to the committee less than the deadline. And while I don't think it's I do think it is a technical bill. It was tacked on in the Senate. We just want to align this bill with the Senate bill, but I don't think this is rises to waiving the amendment 24-hour rule. So it is posted. It's the 964A1, maybe if Mr. Burris or someone from DBS could speak to it, people will know what it's about. But we're not going to vote on it. We're just going to have it out for discussion today, the A1 amendment.
Mr. Burris, did you want to explain the amendment?
Sure, Madam Chair and members. The A1 amendment makes a couple of changes. One regards a variance that's proposed in the bill for identification card issuance for homebound individuals. The A1 amendment would broaden who could identify a condition causing the person to be homebound. And then the second part of the A1 amendment involves the mileage disclosure, odometer disclosure, and it includes a technical change as well as a change to make that effective the day following final enactment.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. And it looks like we have DVS Director Emma Corey here to testify to the bill. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm happy to present on the DBS policy bill. There are five. Should I go through with the five proposed changes? Okay. Thank you.
Looks like we're running short on time too. So.
Absolutely. I can do an abbreviated version. The first one is linking motor vehicle transfer fees in Chapter 168. This is, again, very just basically language when it comes to all of our registration languages in 168, but when it comes to the $10 fee that is charged for each title transfer for motor vehicles weighing more than 1,000 pounds, it is not currently in that section. So what this does is it corrects the language and puts it in the same section for easy reference and easy for both our business partners, like our deputy registrars, as well as our staff to find. The second one is about simplifying partial payment for registration tax for those vehicles that where registration tax is more than $400. They have the opportunity to pay it in installments. Again, basically just a language change. Right now there is language that's kind of unclear. It talks about the installments are due on the first day of the fifth month and the ninth month. This is basically just changing it, keeping it clean and saying July 1 and November 1 for when the installments are due. Again, keeping it clean, easier for folks to know when those payments are due. The third one is tied to deputy registrar fees for dealer vehicle resale notification. When a dealer resells a vehicle, they are expected to provide a notification to DVS. They can ask a deputy registrar to do that on their behalf, and they in turn pay a fee of $7. At the current time, the language says up to, may not exceed $7. We're keeping it clean and just saying a fee of $7 instead of having it say not to exceed $7. And Madam Chair, know that I'm just zipping through it for you. The next one is tied to a photo variance for homebound individuals. I might say on the earlier one that it is supported by dealers and deputy registrars. There is support for that that change. The next one is about photo variance for homebound individuals. Again, right now, customers are required to update their photograph every 4 years when renewing an identification card. Again, a lot of our elders and are using these identification cards for important services, whether it's medical, mobility services, things like that. We're asking for a variance so that they can submit a photo rather than needing to come in person to get that photo taken for a renewal, for an ID that they need for everyday services.
Yes. I'm so sorry, but we are at 2:30, and it doesn't look like we have any OT time available. So I'm going to ask the chair how he would like to proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are going to just lay this one over, also similar to what we did with your bill, really just to make sure that people have a chance to look at that A1 amendment, and if there's any issues around that, because it wasn't posted early. But I think we'll be able to do this soon and line it up with the Senate, and I don't feel a need for action today.
Okay. So the bill is laid over, and with that, I will adjourn the meeting.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.